Hello, I'm Nick Spencer, and you're listening to a new series of Reading Our Times, the podcast about books, about ideas about us. This series, we're looking at playing God, science, religion, and the future of humanity. We're going to be talking about scientific immortality, alien life, animal personhood, the rise in mental ill health, and the soul of AI. And underlying it all, we're going to be thinking about the question that lies at the heart of Reading Our Times. How are we to understand our human condition? The figures speak for themselves. 42% of the rising generation has received treatment from a mental health professional. Over 10% of American kids have received an ADHD diagnosis. Diagnoses of depression and anxiety among US college students more than doubled between 2010 and 2018, and suicide rates rose noticeably too. These data are from the US, but America is, as ever, leading the way, and similar trends can be traced in other developed countries too. Whichever way you look at it, it's not great being young these days. In the words of the book we're talking about this week, we have raised the loneliest, most anxious, depressed, pessimistic, helpless, and fearful generation on record. Why? What on earth is going on here? And what can we do about it? Abigail Schreier is a journalist and a writer for, among other publications, the Wall Street Journal, and she holds academic qualifications from Columbia, Oxford, and Yale. Her new book is called Bad Therapy: Why the Kids Aren't Growing Up. And she joins us on the podcast this week. Abigail, welcome to Reading Our Times.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
It's important to get one thing clear up front, and you make this distinction in a note in the start of your book, which is that the idea of a youth mental health crisis conflates two distinct groups, and you are particularly interested in one of them. Can you unpack that?
Sure. So, you know, this term gets tossed around a lot, our youth mental health crisis, and it's sometimes not clear what we're referring to. There is undoubtedly a crisis among the truly mentally ill. We see them in our streets and all over the major cities of America. They suffer with schizophrenia, in some cases, drug addiction. There are those who suffer with profound cases of major depressive disorder, anorexia, and they all need treatment, and they don't get enough of it, frankly. They are underserved and under-medicated and under-treated as a population. But that's not what I'm talking about in this book. What I'm talking about is a second group. We call them anxious, we call them depressed, but they don't quite have major depressive disorder. They're sort of the bummed out, worried teens all over America, the ones who can't be motivated to seek out a job, are afraid to make any move in their lives without three calls to mom. They're the ones asking their mothers to call their bosses if they're unhappy at work or they want a raise, or to call their professors at university if they're unhappy with a grade. They can't do for themselves. And they tend to have a lot of diagnosis, but we wouldn't call them mentally ill.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the group. I think they are a vastly over-treated, over-medicated group.
And this is a group that has been growing very significantly over the last 20 years, hasn't it?
Yes, they are now getting the lion's share of our mental health resources in this country. And I can tell you, in America, our mental health expenditures have ballooned. They have nearly doubled every decade since 1986. So you're talking about vast expansions and worse results.
And that's a critical point in your
yes.
argument. If we were to pour money into medical services, such as treatment of cancer or dementia or something like that, you would expect to see a commensurate improvement in survival rates, for example. And it's been the opposite for this group, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And you look at other treatments where there was need. I mean, think about death and childbirth, something that's basically unheard of now in the West, thanks to things like antibiotics, where you have a cure come in. You want to see at least a depreciation in the point prevalence rate of the disease. Ideally, you'd like to see it wiped out entirely if it's a very effective medical intervention. Instead, we've seen the opposite. There's more treatment for depression across the West than we've ever had, more psych meds, more therapy, and worse mental health.
And that has manifested itself in more therapies, more wellness centres, more diagnoses of ADHD. Are you able to give us any numbers, any figures that we can get a grip on how prevalent that is in the US?
Sure. So there's a few numbers I can give you. So the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC in America, released a report in 2016 that 1 in 6 children, American children between the ages of 2 and 8, had a mental health or behavioral diagnosis. Now, they weren't on smartphones. They're not on smartphones now. They're definitely not on social media now, but they certainly weren't back in 2016. And yet, as I said, 1 in 6 already had a mental health diagnosis. We're seeing a vast expansion in diagnosis. And today, less than half of the rising generation says its mental health is good. So we're seeing very high reports of people who believe they are unwell, mentally unwell. And of course, if you talk to any teenager, they'll say that. They'll say, oh, that's my anxiety. They never say I'm worried. They never say they're sad. They'll say, oh, I feel depressed.
Yeah.
Okay. They'll never say, oh, I went through a tough time in middle school. They say I have PTSD. So they're self-diagnosing. I mean, their language is the language of psychopathology.
I want to come towards that point because I think the way we frame this entire conversation, the language we use, almost then predetermines how we see it and what we do about it. Before we do, though, a few other questions I want to ask first. The book is primarily focused in the US. Do you have a sense of how prevalent it is beyond the US?
I don't. You know, there have been some reports out of England of very, very high numbers of youth using antidepressants, but some of those were based on surveys. So I'm not sure how accurate they are. So I'm a little leery of quoting them. But let's just say they have been rising steadily. I don't think they are where we are in the US. But most unfortunately, America is a great exporter of its cultural problems.
For what it's worth, that intuitively feels right from my side of the Atlantic. I absolutely recognize the picture that you painted for the US. I felt that it was visible here, but not as prevalent here. But I also felt that that was also the direction of travel here.
It must be because while I was writing this book, a woman I was completely unaware of out of Oxford named Folks is the last name. She was doing a study that I didn't know anything about. In fact, it came out after my book was complete.
Lucy Folks, I think
yes.
It is.
Okay, yes. That's what I thought. She was looking at the wellness techniques and the coping mechanisms and the social emotional interventions at schools in England. And she had a control group. And it was a prospective study, so it was a rigorous study looking at the effects. And she found exactly what my book predicted, that we're seeing in American schools, which is more anxiety, more depression as a result of these unnecessary mental health interventions, and more alienation from mom and dad. And there was a similar study out of Australia. I think Folks was the meta study, so it looked at several different interventions, and there was a different one out of Australia which showed the same.
Yeah.
So exactly as my book predicts, all this unnecessary mental health intervention with kids is convincing them that they're unwell and is making them sadder and sicker and more fearful.
Yeah. This is a big problem. It's a complex problem. Lots of different factors feed in, and I want to pull apart the different factors. And I want to actually begin with the one that you end with almost, which is about parenting. There are certain parental traits and characteristics that are especially prevalent today that you argue are feeding into children's anxiety, such as a different attitude to risk. Tell us about that.
Well, we know that parents are the major vector of anxiety in young children. We are passing on our anxiety to our kids. And in fact, the most effective treatments for anxiety in young children is treating the parents' anxiety. And you see this in everything from our obsessive need to read every parenting book, especially those written by shrinks, to learn about the amygdala as if we can't possibly raise a child without understanding the hippocampus, which of course is ridiculous, partly because no one understands these things very well. As I learned while I was interviewing neuropsychologists and neuropsychiatrists, I mean, they'll be the first to tell you there's very little we know about the emotional sensors of the brain. But nonetheless, there are these gurus out there convincing parents that they can't possibly raise a good child unless they practice these techniques and memorize more of what's sometimes called neurotrash, phony science about the brain. Parents are frantic. They are absolutely fearful that they're going to inflict emotional injury. And I think that's really what they're worried about is trauma.
And there's also this fascinating shift you describe from what you call action orientation to state orientation. I found that really interesting.
So did I. So apparently there's a lot of great psychological research on this, and it's been replicated. It's good, sturdy studies. And they found that before you begin any task, there are roughly two kinds of orientations you can adopt, psychologically speaking. The first is a state orientation. That is focusing on, how am I feeling? Do I have a worry I need to attend to? Did I fail to respond to someone's text? Do I have an ache in my shoulder? Do I have a soreness in my throat? That sort of thing. Thinking about yourself. And then the other option is to adopt an action orientation, focusing entirely on the task ahead and not at all on yourself. And time and again, the people who get tasks done and done well are those that adopt an action orientation. It turns out that if you want to sabotage a person's ability to get things done, making them think about themselves is a good way to do it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's what we're doing in school. In the middle of a school day, when the children are faced with so many tasks, many of them quite demanding, we're asking them, tell me about how you're feeling right now. It's the worst thing we could be doing.
So that introspection, paradoxically, given the way that we see it is so liberating, actually becomes part of the problem, right?
Exactly. And no one is suggesting, least of all me, that if a child has a problem, we say, shut up and focus on the task ahead. No one's saying that. The question is, prophylactically, before a child has indicated any problem, should we be focusing them on their feelings? And the answer is an obvious no.
Another very important area here is, of course, social media. There happens to be another book, in the UK at least, that's coming out about now by Jonathan Haidt, which pretty much lays, I'm sure you know it, The Anxious Generation, pretty much lays the blame for this anxiety that we're talking about at the door of social media. I sense you're 50-50 on this. You recognise the real problem here, but you wouldn't put it down to social media and smartphones, etc., to the extent that he does, right?
Right. Look, I think it's a few things. First of all, social media is bad. It's absolutely acted as an accelerant for our mental health problems, no doubt. My last book was all about a social contagion of trans identification among teenage girls spread largely through social media. So I'm very aware of the dangers of social media for kids. But do I think it fully explains why kids today seem to be suffering? No, I don't. And there are a few reasons why. First of all, in the United States, adolescent mental health has been in precipitous decline since the 1950s.
Right.
And this statistic I mentioned to you earlier, 1 in 6 children ages 2 to 8, those kids aren't on social media. 1 in 6 of them has a mental health or behavioral diagnosis.
I mean, at the age of 2, I find that one truly jaw-dropping.
Right. It is. It is. These kids are being diagnosed for everything. And their parents are frantically, you know, any deviation from the norm, nobody waits it out. They immediately go for a diagnosis and a pill. Okay. There's a few other things to note, too. In societies where they give children more independence, like Israel, like Japan, they do better with things like anxiety and depression, even though they're all on social media. In Israel, they have higher rates of social media even than we do. Their smartphones are everywhere, but they are hanging out in person with friends. And here's what I want people to know. It's not as if children don't know that it's more fun to have contact with friends than sit on their phones. They know. Yeah. It's not the case that teenagers don't know that touching a person is more exciting than internet porn. And it's not that they don't know that chatting to a friend on a device is less fun than hanging out with them in person. They know that. So why are they living like this? Part of it is because they feel unwell. They are taking, in effect, a generational sick day. And if you ask them, they will tell you that. They will say, and they tell their employers, my mental health isn't good today, I need a day off. They have convinced themselves they are ill. I do believe it goes beyond the smartphone.
Yeah. But as a rule, kids are underprotected online and overprotected when they step outside the front door.
Absolutely. I mean, here's one way of saying it, and that is we have too much hitting these kids. Too much tech, too much social media, too much intervention, too much monitoring, too much diagnosis, way too much therapy, and way too much psychiatric medication. And really, we need to proceed by subtraction. We need to take all these things out. If you give them a healthier life, you will have healthier results. And I will tell you this, you can trust them more with social media as well. Mm. It's that their lives are so unhealthy.
I want to ask more specifically about therapy as well, because of course it's in the title of the book, and the first section of the book focuses heavily on therapy. Now, I think it's probably fair to say that there's no initial malign motive in any of this. It's just that the way that the system is set up is that it becomes almost self-fulfilling. There's a perverse anti-incentive in there when you say that the therapist often doesn't want to acknowledge that the medicine isn't working because she is the medicine. So it was almost in their interests to over-recognize the problems that they are then the treatment for, right?
That's exactly right. They are a vastly under-monitored profession, okay? Almost anything counts as therapy today. And except for there are very good treatments for very serious disorders, and there are treatments for minor phobias and things like that that can be effective. The problem is a lot of therapists who sit around with a teenager, they're just looking around for problems and they are rehashing sadness, all of which can create more problems. And unlike an adult who can say, you know what, I don't think this is helping. It's much harder for a child to say, I don't think it's fair to call my mother emotionally abusive, especially if the patient is 14 years old and pretty angry with mom to begin with.
Mm. Yes. I mean, there's, I have to say, quite a few chilling facts and stories in the book, but I think one of the ones that made me shiver most was the prospect of big tech getting involved in all this with the development of mental health apps. You report that over $3 billion was poured into mental health tech startups in the 15 months following COVID. You have here a perfect combination of social media on the one hand with a kind of self-diagnosing therapeutic culture,
right.
Neither of which by themselves is healthy, but put together and that's giving people the opportunity to make money out of it, it'd be a catastrophe.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. I mean, look, social media is bad, but if you think having a child hooked up to an AI-driven mental health app that's constantly asking the child, do you feel lonely? How lonely do you feel? Rate your loneliness now. I mean, that is a recipe for depression. It really, truly is.
Yeah, yeah. And without even the immediate accountability of a counselor being there, because the person who designed the app is absolutely nowhere visible.
And frankly, a lot of the counselors don't even know the psychological research. I mean, every researcher I talked to admitted and freely acknowledged there are harms that therapy can cause. Any treatment, if it can be effective, also has the potential to harm. And there's a well-known body of literature on the iatrogenic harms of therapy. That is when the therapy introduces the harm, when the healer introduces the harm. This is true of every medication, acetaminophen or x-rays or anything can introduce harm. That's why we have to use it carefully. Mm. And unfortunately, the idea that has been completely pervasive in the United States for decades now is that therapy can only help. Talking about your problems is always the best solution. It's not true. It's never been true. And it's leading kids to exaggerate their problems. Mm. In the book, I call them emotional hypochondriacs. They're basically people whose hyper attention to their real emotional pain. They may have some, you know, we all have disappointments and pains and frustrations, but the hyper focus and then turning it into an organizing principle of life, we are turning a generation into emotional hypochondriacs.
And it's really important to emphasize that we all have this. One of the things that really leapt out for me from the book is when you say relatively early on, happiness is actually a very rare emotional state, statistically speaking. That's such a liberating fact. When you wake up in the morning and you feel miserable, nothing wrong with you, you're just human.
It is, isn't it? People treat it like, oh, well, what does that mean? We want to be happy all the time. Actually, no, it's very rare. And you know what? That's what makes it so wonderful. Mm. It's wonderful because most of life, you have an itch, you have an allergy, you have a worry, you have something you're self-conscious about. That's most of life. And telling kids they're supposed to be happy all the time and parents neurotically checking in that they're happy. Are you enjoying your ice cream? Are you having fun at the park? The studies show this is the exact way to make someone less happy. And unfortunately, I think that's what we're doing to an entire generation.
in a previous age, it might have been called the human condition, which is something that we often return to in reading our times. There's one other really interesting big turn in this conversation that I think is worth picking up, because we've talked about social media, we've talked about parenting, we've talked about the therapeutic term. It is what I call in a book that I've just written, the pharmacological turn, which is that we understand the brain better now than we did 30 years ago. As you say, we don't understand it well, but we understand it better. We have some pharmacological ways of treating that. And so that often becomes our first port of call. And that itself has the potential to cause real harm, doesn't it?
That's right. I'm a journalist, so I had to interview a lot of these psychiatric experts. But from what I understand, we sort of know just enough to have a certain amount of hubris that we know a lot. We don't know very much about the brain. We don't know very much about why antidepressants or how they seem to put a cap on depression. Of course, if someone needs these drugs, you know, and can't function without them, by all means, they should do it. The problem is, do they depress all emotion? Do they depress the happiness as well? Do they put a cap on that? They seem to come with all kinds of side effects, like deleting sex drive, like a certain numbing of the conscience, a certain feeling like you're not really inhabiting your own life. These are all choices that an adult may make. The problem is, a child, by its very nature, a work in progress. And if you go in there and you make these changes in a child, you're doing something very profound before you've even seen if the child may emerge in a year less sad. And the other thing is, our hair trigger for administering these drugs is so extreme. It's so hypersensitive. In America, we use the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM, as our main guide for diagnosis. And we no longer exempt from the category of depression things like loss of a loved one. Well, yes. Being sad after you lose a loved one is not only normal, it's not only something that we are built to naturally recover from, which we are, but also there'd be something wrong with you if you didn't experience that. But instead, we go in with a pill. And as one wonderful academic psychologist put to me, an academic psychiatrist had repeated this story to him about a patient who came to her psychiatrist and said, "I want to go off these drugs." And he said, "Why, are they not working?" She said, "No, they work great. They eliminated my depression." And he said, "Well, then why do you want to go off them?" She said, "Because I'm married to the same alcoholic jerk."
Exactly.
And that's the problem. Sometimes they make you feel less bad, but they may also delete your will to make a change in your life that you need to make.
Or they treat the symptoms rather than the cause.
Exactly.
Or they do treat the symptoms rather than the cause. I mean, the parallel with physical pain is a very telling one there. Physical pain is the proper, natural and healthy reaction to a negative stimulus, without which we could not, as an organism, survive. Well, you know, there's a very strong argument to make that you do make in the book, that anxiety and depression exist for a reason, and they are very unpleasant responses to, or as you say, having an alcoholic husband or being unemployed or whatever it might be.
That's exactly right. Anxiety makes us alert to danger. It improves performance. It may even help us make clearer memories. We don't want to delete it unless we have to. Depression very often shuts our system down so that we can think about what we may have done wrong or a change we need to make in our life and gather the will to make it. And, you know, maybe it's because we've become so secular and so we see no route to forgiveness. But we seem unable in our current society to admit that we did anything wrong. That's part of why the trauma narrative is so attractive to us. Oh, it's not my fault. I was traumatized in childhood. That's why my marriage fell apart. And you know what? We used to be able to acknowledge, I made a bad decision. I shouldn't have married this guy. I saw the signs. I won't do it again next time. But somehow we've become so incapable of just being honest about those things. And so therefore, we can't bear the thought that it's our fault at all. Unfortunately, that also means we're divesting ourselves of the resources for doing anything about it.
This introduces the critical dimension of agency into this whole debate. A good friend of mine many years ago who suffered from very genuine mental ill health once said to me that I have been diagnosed with depression, but actually what I think I suffer from is despair rather than depression. And it's extremely interesting comment, because depression, really, he couldn't do anything about. He was treated as an object, given drugs, so on and so forth, given treatment. Whereas despair, it is a more existential ailment, which you have some capacity to try and navigate through. I'm not saying it's not hard, not saying it's not difficult, but I think the evacuation of agency in all this is very, very painful and almost prevents people from navigating their own way through.
That's exactly right. Especially in the United States, we give people unhealthy lives and then we pour in mental health resources expecting it to cure everything. And it doesn't. They end up more miserable, but on 10 psychiatric drugs. And you know, when they do these studies, it's remarkable that a regular exercise of virtually any kind lifts mood better than psychotherapy or psychiatric medications for mild to moderate depression. Dancing is amazingly good for mood. Dancing, joining a community, doing things for others, surrounding yourself and surrounding our children with people who love them over a lifetime. I'm talking about grandparents, cousins, uncles, aunts, the ones who won't keep you on the couch for a decade. But we'll tell you, oh, you'll be fine. Don't worry. They'll listen to your troubles. They really care about the answer, but they won't milk it for decades.
So this point about agency then leads us back to what I think is the most interesting thing in this whole debate, which is how we frame it, how we understand it, and what language we use to describe it. You talk about in the book a loss of a moral framing in favour of a therapeutic one. You say early on, instead of using moral language to describe misbehaviour, educated parents begin to employ therapeutic language. And it seems to me that at first that seems liberating because it's not my fault. But in the longer term, the abandonment of that moral framing and the agency that comes with it is incredibly costly, right?
Absolutely. I mean, gosh, I think about the men I've known who will tell you, oh, I was a crazy kid. I was so badly behaved. And at some point, they grew up, they matured, and at some point they decided, I'm going to knock it off. I'm not going to keep doing these things to provoke my teachers or my classmates. I'm not going to get into fights anymore. But if you have a mental disorder, if you tell your child, no, you have oppositional defiance disorder, then only...
Oppositional defiance disorder. That's
yes,
a new one on me.
That's a new one. It's what they now call many young kids who are behavior problems. That's what they get diagnosed with today. And it's one of these murky definitions. Any child who acts out can get it. And they start you on a medication. And that's not something you can fix on your own. Again, to the agency problem. And by the way, to my mind, that's the single most troubling aspect of the rising generation. They don't believe, they have an external locus of control. They don't believe they can improve their own circumstances. And if you just think back a couple generations, you think back to your grandparents, and the amount of agency they had, so young, I can do, here's what I can do. As small children, they were working, they were helping out, they were doing chores, right? Today, young people don't believe they can even make a change to improve their own lives, let alone help the family.
I'm very supportive of much of what you say, but maybe things are dreadful for young people today in an objective sense. Let me give you a couple of examples. If you're a young person in the UK today and you get to tertiary education, you are going to come out of it with £50,000 worth of debt that I didn't 30 years ago. You are vastly less likely to own your own property at least for 10, 15, 20 years or so. And whereas climate change can be overblown into panic, I think there is good reason to believe that, contrary to what you say, that trends aren't going in the right direction there, and there is genuinely something significant, possibly existential, to worry about. My kids are 19 and 17. They're not tearing themselves apart over these issues, but I think they've got it a lot tougher than I did in the 90s. Aren't they right to be this worried?
It's a really important question, because there are aspects of life that are worse. There are no question, and harder. We did not evolve to handle being made fun of in front of a million people. We are people who can be resilient to being made fun of in front of our classmates. That we don't need to panic over. That's what adults are panicking over. It's totally unnecessary. But being humiliated in front of a million people, that none of us is ready for. Certainly not our kids. The level of exposure of these children is very high, and it's unhealthy. There's no question. I actually think there's great cause for optimism when it comes to the climate, not because I don't believe that the Earth might be warming and that there are concerning climate trends, but there are also very reassuring ones, from carbon emissions to the decline of deaths from natural disasters. And also, if you are concerned about the climate, that's not a reason to despair. That's a reason to get a degree and consider what you might contribute to working on these problems. So that's a much healthier response. The debt is a serious problem. There's no question. Kids are leaving with way too much debt. And I don't doubt that that's a significant strain on a lot of kids. And I don't think they should be taking out that much debt. These are problems that we need to solve. But are they bigger than dealing with fascism of Nazi Germany? Is it bigger than what we faced in the Cold War? The Great Depression?
You're absolutely not denying the fact that there are, you know, significant and serious reasons for concern. It's more the issue of how we approach them and how we frame them and how we respond to them, right?
Absolutely. The response should be, let's get to work. That should be the response. Then they should absolutely organize and think about what they can do to alleviate student debt problems or any number of other things. So absolutely, they should get involved. But checking out, that's the worst response of all. We have faced hard things before. The problem is that our attitude today is so bad.
Reading Our Times describes itself as a podcast about books, about ideas, about us. So my concluding question tends to be, what does what we've been talking about say about the human condition? What's your answer to that?
The human condition, we are built for adversity. Adversity is not the problem. Adversity is how we get stronger. It's the exercise bike. That's what it is. We are built for it. Every psychological study shows this. Most combat veterans who see the most horrific things will not develop PTSD. Most of them. And children who go through traumatic experiences, who face abuse, most of them on their own will recover just fine. Now, not all of them, but we have to remember that the story of humanity, that none of us would be here if it weren't for our native ability to overcome adversity and be good citizens and solid people and good spouses and good parents and good workers, right? Good neighbors. And right now we have a generation that doesn't know it can. They don't know we're built for adversity.
The book is called Bad Therapy: Why the Kids Aren't Growing Up. Abigail Shreer, thank you very much indeed for speaking to Reading Our Times.
Thank you so much. It was really my pleasure.
Next week, I'll be speaking to Jenny Kleeman about her book, The Price of Life.
I just worry that we are already in this very data-driven world where metrics matter so much. And I worry that numbers are going to come to be even more powerful than they are now. And the qualitative is going to be squeezed out simply because it's less useful for algorithms.
You've been listening to Reading Our Times from the think tank Theos. It's produced by Phil Bodger. Our team includes Daniel Turner, Fiona Hanscom, and Chinny McDonald. Special thanks to Nina Humphreys, who composed our theme tune and all the music. You can subscribe to Reading Our Times on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and you can also find us on the website theosthinktank.co.uk. We're going to be doing a few live events at festivals in the coming months, so please sign up to the Theos monthly newsletter and join us in person for those if you can. And don't forget to rate and review the podcast on iTunes. It'll help other people find it. Goodbye.